Robert, I'm hosting this week, as you know, from Southern California. Lots of great things about being out here, as you know. There is, though, one downside, and that is that I'm missing out today on something very special there in Washington.
That's right. It's something that has become an all things considered Monday tradition.
Cake!
That's Melissa Gray. She's one of our producers. And listeners, I bet a lot of you have someone like her in your office. Just about every Monday, she dashes off a staff email that goes something like this.
Up front, we've got sweet potato pound cake. Still warm. Dig in. Don't be shy.
Well, that goes without saying on our staff. When Melissa started bringing cake into the office, she discovered we will eat just about anything. Her adventures in baking and our adventures in eating, which she created, are now told in a cookbook. It's called All Cakes Considered, a year's worth of weekly recipes tasted, tested, and approved by the staff of All Things Considered. And before I headed out here to NPR West, I popped over to Melissa Gray's house outside Washington as she put one of those cakes together.
Look over here. This is where it all happens, this little itty-bitty kitchen.
This little tiny RV-sized kitchen. Yeah.
She decided to make that sweet potato pound cake perfect for this time of year.
Now I have a bunch of sweet potatoes that I baked last night, which is one reason why the house smells so good.
They look great.
Melissa, do you want to do this?
Are we going to mash?
Yeah, I'm going to let you mash.
I love mashing.
Melissa Gray steers her book toward the beginning baker with tips she's learned along the way from family and friends, often laced with her trademark Southern sass. Don't stomp around the kitchen while your cake is baking, she writes. Proceed with your cleanup placidly and calmly, like you're on Prozac or Valium, and everything is fine, fine, fine with the stock market. Our sweet potato pound cake batter is thick, a pretty pale orange.
This is a 1 hour and 15 minute one. And I got
a couple of hours and a subway ride later, Melissa arrives at the office cake in hand, and it exerts a gravitational pull on our staff.
It's a sweet potatoes in it, which are healthy.
Oh my God.
Man.
And nuts, which are also.
All right, can I have a thimbleful?
Is Tom here today?
That looks so great. Yeah. He is?
He needs to get down quick.
Should I page him?
Yeah.
The cake is gone in less than 10 minutes. A new land speed record, Melissa says with pride.
Would you like to take some of the crumbs off of our...
Whatever you give me, I will eat happily.
Melissa Gray says it's that kind of reaction that keeps sending her back to her mixer.
I love watching our staff. All of these incredibly competent, brilliant, efficient people taken back to being like 8 years old. And having that little joy. Oh, there's cake. I love that because it makes you remember that people at their core are still, you know, human beings.
Are you sort of peeking over the edge of your cubicle, kind of watching the response, seeing
I keep track of who doesn't get cake. I do. And I check with them and I'm like, did you get a slice of cake today? You know, you know, I want everybody to join in. I want everybody to share in the community of having the cake. It's like breaking bread. Because in a way, it does bind us. It's that one moment where we don't have to worry about the next deadline. It's an enjoyable moment.
Let's tick through some NPR names and the cakes that they love. Michelle Norris.
Michelle loves just about everything.
Uh-huh.
She's easily pleased. She is very easily pleased. She does not like coconut.
No coconut for Michelle.
No coconut for Michelle.
Okay. Robert Siegel.
Robert does not eat cake, he claims.
He claims.
I have seen Robert take cookies, though.
We know.
Well, you're the fried pie, brown sugar pound cake, and bittersweet chocolate frosted layer cake person.
Morning Edition host, Steve Inske.
He likes butterscotch. He's a butterscotch guy.
Wouldn't have pegged him for a butterscotch guy.
Steve's full of surprises.
How about our film critic, Bob Mondello?
Bob Mondello loves coconut cake because his birthday is near Easter, and every year when he was growing up, when he had his birthday cake, it was a coconut cake. So when I'm there and it's his birthday week and I remember, I make him a coconut cake. Now sometimes I have to please the people who don't like coconut, so what I do is I do half coconut on one side and just a regular vanilla cake on the other side so Michelle can get her slice and Bob can get his half a cake.
What about Dan Shore, our venerable news analyst?
He's partial to frosting. He likes cake as a delivery system for frosting.
I know people like that.
There are people like that. It's true.
Well, Melissa, thank you for keeping us so well fed all these Mondays.
You're welcome. And I, you know, at some point, I think we're going to have to do Monday aerobics too, because everybody was complaining that I'm just making them too fat.
I think it's time.
That's All Things Considered producer Melissa Gray. Her new cookbook is All Cakes Considered, a year's worth of weekly recipes tasted, tested, and approved by the staff of All Things Considered. And you can find the recipe for her sweet potato pound cake at our website, npr.org.
And Melissa, I have a confession to make.
Yes.
That I actually did have, knowing that there was an All Things Considered piece at stake, I did have a piece of the sweet potato pound
you
cake.
You tried it.
And I tried. It was pretty good.
You claim to not be a cake eater. You actually wrote the foreword to Melissa Gray's book, and you write in there, "I am the rare colleague who does not eat the cake she brings to work." But you actually do.
On occasion. But despite the rarity of that, Melissa did ask me to write the foreword to the book, which is a credit to her sense of irony.
Exactly.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. The following words may make your mouth water. Buttermilk biscuits, baby back ribs, fried chicken, sweet potato spoon bread, pork chops, pecan pie. These dishes appear on the table regularly at family dinners, reunions, and holidays. But Southern-style cooking, when done well, is an art form. Barbara Smith, better known as B. Smith, helped transform down-home cooking into cuisine. Her restaurants, called B. Smith's, feature a variety of Southern dishes, and now some of her recipes can be found in her new book, B. Smith Cooks Southern Style. One of her restaurants is located in Washington, D.C.'s Union Station, not far from NPR. We were invited over, and B. Smith gave us a tour of the restaurant's historic dining room.
This is beautiful.
Thank
I've never you. Been in here.
Let me give you a little history. This is the former presidential suites when the presidents traveled by rail. This is the main dining room. Back there is the president's signing room. We have an official, as you can see, our seal up here.
Oh, yeah.
And back there, it was a special place where he might do some signing before or be greeted and sign something when he came in. This was the president's private room. It was a dressing room. It had all the facilities back there. And over on the other side was the first lady's dressing room. And I now call this the first lady's room because I like the entrance out here to the colonnade.
Well, it's your property now,
right,
so you
right.
can do what you want. Well, let's go sit and talk about
okay.
the food. Tell us a little bit about your new cookbook. It's called B. Smith Cooks Southern Style.
Yes.
I know Southern food is the specialty of the restaurant, but you're not from the South.
I'm not from the South, and I always tell people, though, I'm from southwestern Pennsylvania. But if you are of African-American descent, somewhere along the line, in your heritage, you have family that's lived in the South. So a lot of my family lived in North Carolina. So when we were young, my dad would drive us only as far as the family in North Carolina South. But the foods that my mother cooked in western Pennsylvania were Southern foods.
Do you remember a picture in your mind of like your first time in a kitchen and having something to do with food that wasn't just eating it?
Yes, canning. We had a garden, and we canned tomatoes and beans and all kinds of things, and then much later, we froze them. Because early on, when I was very young, so I'm telling my age, there weren't the big freezers that we eventually had. But what I really loved at home was homemade root beer.
Really?
Yes. And we had the amber bottles, the capper. I mean, so food and beverage has always been a part of my life.
And always came, it seems, from someplace not too far from where you were living.
Exactly.
And comfort food.
Right.
Which has this connotation of having as much cheese, butter, fat, even the stuff that's good for you, the collards. I mean,
right.
Some people still make them with the ham hock.
And I have a recipe in here with with a ham hock, but I tell people how to defat the ham hock.
Tell us how to defat.
And what you do is, you know, you boil the ham hocks like you normally would with whatever spices you wanted to put in them, and after you boil them and they're falling off the bone, I let them cool down to room temperature, and then I put them back in the refrigerator overnight. And what happens is the fat rises to the top.
So then I can
skim it off and then proceed with the recipe.
That's a great way to make that healthy.
I don't feel guilty.
Yeah.
It's healthy.
but you admit that you'd like to cook with one special ingredient, fat.
Well, I love fat. I mean, I love, and I say it, that I love it in the book because it adds such great flavor.
Right.
But in moderation to these days, because I really think that all of us should be conscious of that fat intake because it's just not, you know, it's not the healthiest thing. I even have now olive oil.
Ah.
And I am introducing olive oil to the folks in my restaurant. Eventually, and particularly like in a city like D.C., it's a southern city.
Sure.
Most people are used to butter, but I'm offering the alternative and just try it with the bread and see if you like it.
We find the people responsible for implementing those healthier changes in the kitchen. But not everything can be perfectly healthy.
What are you making?
Good morning.
Roux?
Roux.
Roux. That's butter, flour, a little stock, or did...
Just butter and
just
flour.
Just butter and flour, getting that ready.
For bourbon sauce.
For bourbon sauce. Man, roux is like the cornerstone of everything.
I'm a northerner. I come from New England. Mm-hmm. I come from the land of, clam bakes and New England boiled dinners. Do you think I could learn how to cook Southern style?
Absolutely. This is a Frogmore stew on the cover.
Okay, so there's shrimp,
corn on the cob. It's got some sausage in it. And again, you can get lighter sausage, but it's very flavorful and it's fresh. And so you could do your twist on it, and you might want to add a little lobster, you might want to add, but give it its New England flair. But that's what I like about recipe books.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is a map, and then you take that map and you go where you want to go with it. Books, cookbooks in particular, are very challenging, but they give back a lot. So.
They sure do. Do you read them?
I do. Love to read them.
I think they're great nighttime reading.
I do, too. I mean, magazines that are food magazines, I love to read, too.
Let me ask you about food magazines.
Oh.
Gourmet. November issue, last one.
Right.
What do you think about that? I mean, that's something that's been around since 1941.
You know, I'm saddened that that the magazine is being discontinued. But there are a lot of food magazines that give recipes in a more modern way for the way the person cooks today.
Right, right. We don't have all day to make a dish.
We don't. I mean, this is a hearty book, but yet in the promo of the book I talk about, you know, the alternatives for many different recipes from, you know, appetizers to desserts that are healthier. But I still have very soulful dishes and, you know, heartwarming soups that are very important in the stews. But I have a rabbit stew.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbit is coming back again. Of course, my husband is like not wanting to eat the little critter. But I also have...
you have a roast turkey. I mean, you got Thanksgiving coming. Cornbread oyster dressing.
Yes.
How do you make that?
You know what? You make it almost like you make a regular dressing, but you're just adding oysters chopped up, and you could add some of that that nice jus, the jus. I like dressing up cornbread. And for the holidays, you should have a little something extra, like the turducken.
Oh,
did
no.
Did you see that?
Yes. With the turkey is stuffed with a duck, which has been stuffed with a chicken.
Right, with three different dressings in between. So I took liberty on mine. Mine is a roulade, and I do it in steps. So it's a real, it has its own chapter.
So it's a Herculean effort, but you've broken it down into steps.
Right. And it might be something one wants to do with a sister, a pal, where maybe they do all the dressings, and you do, you know, you make sure you have the turkey and the duck and the chicken.
Oh,
and so, and I think that could be fun. If you have people staying over and people who love, someone who loves to cook, then you can, you have it right in front of you, and you can tell people what to do, exactly what to do.
Yeah. Barbara Smith is the author of the new cookbook, B. Smith Cooks Southern Style. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Hungry for more? You'll find Barbara Smith's recipes for Southern Style collard greens and braise of black-eyed peas and green soup on our website, npr.org. Yum.
As this nation heads into the heavy eating season, NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg is back from a country where it was once impossible to get a bad meal. Then things went downhill. Now, says Susan, great French food is coming back.
Americans who were lucky enough to go to France decades ago never forgot their first encounter with great French cooking. For Michael Steinberger, it was some peas he ate in the Loire Valley in 1980.
And you think, you're 13-year-old American kid, what the hell do you know from peas? But that was the thing. The peas were so absolutely delicious. I never tasted anything this good.
Some 30 years later, in a book called Au Revoir to All That, Food, Wine, and the End of France, Steinberger says those pea epiphanies are long past for various reasons.
France is now McDonald's second most profitable market in the world.
And McDonald's is the largest private sector employer in the country. A McDo's, as they call it, will open in the food court of the Louvre. Sacre bleu! What happened? Well, working families have less time for home cooking. Young people aren't raised on great food. French wine, cheese, and bread makers have had all kinds of problems. Plus, running a restaurant is hard work in France. High taxes, loads of bureaucracy, stifling rules.
You've seen a lot of young chefs, very talented ones, leave to open restaurants in New York and London because it was a heck of a lot easier to open a business in these cities and to run one and to turn a profit.
But there is a mini revolution underway, a rethinking and reviving of classic French cooking. The heck with the demanding Michelin rating system that awards coveted and stress-producing stars to formal, fortune-charging temples of food. The new way, Michael Steinberger says, is called bistronomy.
Bistronomy is this idea that's taken root here in Paris of young, very talented chefs who have decided, you know what, we don't want anything to do with this Michelin system. We don't care about winning 3 stars. We don't want to have these luxury palaces where you've got 5 or 6 people in penguin suits hovering over you. We don't want to do that, and the clientele doesn't want it anymore. What they want is good food at a price they can afford.
Their guru is a cheerful, scratchy-voiced dynamo named Christian Constant. 59 now, Constant began apprenticing in kitchens when he was 14. For 8 years, he was chef at the Crillon, one of Paris's top hotels. He walked away from a pretty certain 3rd star there and opened a small place near the Eiffel Tower. Leave the Crillon? Constant's Scottish wife, Catherine, tells why.
He had the impression that he was falling asleep in the kitchen, that he was getting a bit stagnating.
So he left and encouraged a generation of marvelous young chefs who'd apprenticed with him over the years to do the same. Now Christian Constant has 4 small and lively restaurants all on the same Paris street. One serves mostly fish, another casseroles. The French president ate there. A 3rd is a corner cafe, and the 4th is an upscale bistro. On a recent Saturday night, Parisians began arriving at 7, for them a decidedly unchic hour, to get tables and terrific food at reasonable prices.
On est à l'aise, on travaille pas avec la peur.
Now we have this restaurant where everybody enjoys working, and we love the relationship that we have with the clients now. It's much more relaxed, but still professional.
I'm eating a scallop, and then qu'est-ce que c'est? Du beurre?
Ouais, c'est du beurre, du jus d'orange.
Constant's kitchens are tiny and jammed with soups and stocks and sous chefs. It's like a rugby team, he says. Playing alone, you're nothing. But together, it's really back to bon appetit. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News, with recent memories of scallops and butter and oranges and peas and endives.
Alas, there are no nibbles, but you can get a list of restaurants, some pictures, menus at NPR.org. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
If you're a fan of raw oysters, here's some news you can use. The Food and Drug Administration plans to stop the sale of raw oysters harvested from the Gulf of Mexico during the warm months unless they've been treated to destroy potentially deadly bacteria. About 15 people die in the U.S. each year from eating raw oysters. Michael Taylor is senior advisor to the FDA commissioner. And Mr. Taylor, tell us more about this bacteria and what you're concerned about here.
Well, this particular bacteria called Vibrio vulnificus grows in warm waters. So in southern waters, such as the Gulf of Mexico, during summer months, this bacteria is more present in the water. It infects the oysters, and it happens to be a very deadly oyster. So half of the people who get an infection from this oyster die from it.
The guidance has been avoid oysters in any month that doesn't include the letter R, right?
Yes. I mean, that's been what we've known for ages, that this is the practical guidance to protect people. So what we're really just saying is that if you want to sell an oyster, you know, harvested in these warm waters, then we're simply saying treat it with the process that we know kills the bacteria and makes it safe.
Well, what's that process?
Well, there's several different processes that include forms of freezing, includes subjecting the oysters to pressure, you know, other techniques. And what we've said is that, you know, given that we've got a set of technologies that are effective and essentially, you know, largely reducing this risk to zero, processors should either use one of those available technologies, or if there's another way to achieve the same result, given that we know we can really address this hazard with available technology, you know, that's the right standard of care to protect people to avoid unnecessary death.
Even if the number is rather small, if you consider the total population, 15 deaths a year.
I personally don't consider 15 deaths a year to be a small number if they're avoidable. If it's known to be a preventable death, you know, one death is too many.
Michael Taylor is senior advisor to the FDA commissioner. Thanks for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
We're going to hear now from an oyster wholesaler. The P&J Oyster Company has been processing and distributing oysters from the Gulf for more than 130 years. Al Sanseri owns the company. He joins me from the headquarters in New Orleans. Mr. Sanseri, what do you think about this plan from the FDA?
Well, I think that it's wrong. We've never been epidemiologically linked to a Vibrio vulnificus illness. So to think that it's one of our oysters would be involved in a illness case is not true.
What do you think about those techniques that Michael Taylor was describing there to treat the oysters, high pressure, freezing temperatures, gamma radiation, things like that?
I personally believe that they serve a purpose, but for the general population, it's unnecessary. I hate being put in a position to defend what my family has done for generations.
And what would it mean for your business if you couldn't sell oysters from the Gulf during the warm months?
Well, even more so than that, we wouldn't be in business because we're located in the French Quarter of New Orleans. My facility is not large enough to put in any of the processes that are available. I would not be able to be in the business any longer, and we're talking about a fifth-generation business.
And if you were going to treat the oysters the way the FDA says you would have to, do you think the oyster would taste the same?
Tastes are up to the individual. I have not really eaten those oysters, so I'm not really the best one to ask.
You've eaten a lot of oysters, though.
Every day of my life for the last 30 years, so I could call my customers and tell them what they taste like.
And in the warm months, doesn't give you any worry?
I've never had a concern. We sell oysters 12 months out of the year and have for 133 years. We have boats that have refrigeration on board. Our trucks are refrigerated. We don't leave them out. We handle them with lots of care. And there are good ways to handle your oysters where the consumer can be protected.
Mr. Sunseri, thanks very much.
You're quite welcome.
Al Sunseri owns the P&J Oyster Company in New Orleans.